I had people throw me out of the office. And then we did a little trick on it. And I promise you, that same guy called me back a week later saying, maybe we might have a look at this.
Hello and welcome to V for Visionaries podcast with me, Richard Ward. I am an award-winning serial entrepreneur with over 35 years experience in the beauty and media world. And I've built and sold many businesses. But today I'm most interested in finding out who are the movers and shakers in business, what makes them so successful, and why certain cream rises to the top.
And me, Rosamund Stenhouse. I am an award-winning fourth generation of entrepreneurs. I have spent several decades working with all aspects of land, delivering new towns and large-scale landmass for development. I now work with national and international entrepreneurs, scaling, improving sales, and expanding their business. This is the podcast where bold ideas meet business brilliance.
Yes, and each week we'll be sitting down with trailblazing entrepreneurs and industry leaders to uncover the strategies, the stories, and the secrets behind some of the world's most exciting business ventures. Well, we have such an exciting guest today. Really excited about this one. Please welcome Marcus Lua, founder of SMRF Capital and TSA Total Sports Asia. Starting from nothing, Marcus Lua is the archetypal self-made man and has been on the cutting edge of the sports industry for no less than 30 years. So with offices all over the world, please welcome, we're very excited, Marcus Lua. Marcus, what we always like to do, as in most podcasts, of course, I got to take you all the way back. And by the way, you're talking to an absolute avid sports fan of all sports, right? So this is a really exciting one for me. But I'll take you all the way back. Where'd you come from? Were you born with a silver spoon in your mouth? Did your parents give you all your brains? How did you get into sport?
Well, being a podcast host myself, the way you're starting is exactly the way I start my podcast, because I do believe it's important to understand a bit where people come from. And so I'll give you the short version of my last 50 plus years on this planet. Come from Germany, Cologne, where I'm currently, where you're catching me here, normally based out of Bangkok. We'll get to that later. And ended up studying in the United States, did an MBA there, and was lucky to be around when the 1994 World Cup arrived on the shores of the US for the first time. Obviously, they're coming back in 2 years. Being German, I figured, you know, this is the closest I'm ever going to get to this thing, probably. And actually, at that time, my story too. I ended up with an internship during my MBA years with American Airlines, and my sort of line, and I kind of paraphrase, I'm sure, but it was, I know more about football than the entire staff in the building here, and so you need me, and why don't I help you with some of the marketing? And he basically said, I think you're right, Marcus, you hired. And I ended up working then for American Airlines for a period of time there to help them on their marketing communication or some of the things. And again, there's a whole podcast you can just do on that.
But Marcus, sorry to interrupt. Did you leave? So you did your MBA, but did you leave as a marketeer?
Yeah, I guess so. My background was marketing for sure. My degree was in marketing and international business. And so I always saw myself, I guess, as a bit of a marketing guy. Later on, I realized I was also reasonably good at selling. So it became a marketing sales, I guess, sort of career on the back of it.
But Marcus, what prompted a German boy? Did you grow up in the country or city?
I come from Cologne, so that's a reasonable, decent-sized city. Yeah, so I'm not a country boy, no.
Why on earth would you go to America? How did you know to go there?
I think in those days, the US was sort of a bit the cool place to be. In Germany, you like probably in the UK, we were watching American movies and American music. And it was just, you know, for me, it was a bit of a dream. My English was terrible. And I figured, you know, maybe a good idea as well to learn it better. So when I arrived there, I was basically living off a dictionary. I was just, you know, every other word I had to look up and stuff. It was quite interesting.
What age were you? How old were you?
So I was 21, 22 when I left.
And did your mother and father, just before you shoot off away from your early years, was your mother and father an entrepreneur?
Yeah. So my parents have a jewelry business. So they were entrepreneurs running their own business. My mom was probably more the entrepreneur. So I always think I caught a bit of that entrepreneurship from her. My dad was the jeweler, as he was more the creative person in the household. Yeah, and I grew up above the business.
Oh, how cool.
The business was, you know, on the first floor, and we were living above it. So yeah, it was quite interesting to watch that, in a good and a bad way. It made very clear to me I'm never going to be in that industry. This was not for me, and I always had somewhat, I guess, I don't know. Cologne is a bit reasonably good sized city, but the business was more in the suburbs, and so the whole place was too small for me.
Yeah,
I think.
So. Oh, I can see that. So you then decided go to America to follow perhaps the American dream, but you then left America.
Yeah, so So left. You know, had great 4.5 years in the U.S. As I said, had some amazing experiences working with American Airlines. I worked initially when I came there. I worked in a company as well. It was like they called it career training program at the time. And, ending up working at the Football World Cup, to me, it was very clear that's the industry I wanted to be in. I always thought myself more as, I don't know, VP of marketing of Coca-Cola or God knows what, you know, big consumer brand. That was sort of where I thought I might end up in a sense, because of that I enjoyed the marketing side. But once I, you know, once you, I guess, get a taste of the world of sports and realize that what you would do for free, someone pays you for, that's it. You know, that was basically it. And so I was hooked. And so after the World Cup in the U.S. in 94, you know, you can imagine there are probably 10,000 people working at it around the World Cup in some capacity. And everyone has probably the same idea I had. So, you know, jobs in the industry or jobs with agencies was somewhat limited. By sheer coincidence or luck, maybe I had sent one CV off to Asia, to a particular group or company or people I met during the World Cup. And they called me back and say, "Hey, Marcus, we just got your CV on the table here. We're looking for guys like you. You want to come to Hong Kong?"
Wow.
And I said, sure.
Yeah. Hong Kong,
sign
back
me
in the
up.
Day, yeah.
Yeah. So this is right. Pretty much a few weeks after, or a couple, you know, months after. So some early September, which is so, and I say around now, 30 years ago, I packed my bag from, at that time I was living in Dallas, and ended up in Hong Kong.
Wow. That's a great, your age is changing, by the way, 30 years.
Yeah.
So what did you go to Hong Kong to do?
So that particular company, it was called World Sport Group, or at that time actually it was the Asia Sport Group. It was a small marketing, sports marketing agency who had taken over Asian football. So think of the UEFA as European football.
Yep.
In Asia, you have the same. It's called the AFC. And they had just taken over that part. And it was successful. They're doing well within the first year or two. And they wanted to do the same in basketball. So my remit was take over Asian basketball.
So you're in Hong Kong.
That was early days.
Yeah. So you're sitting in Hong Kong and you're deciding, actually, do you know what? I'm just going to try and do it myself.
I only spent about a year in Hong Kong and then moved to Malaysia, which was at that time the company I was with. We were also starting the Asian PGA Golf Tour, as in a professional golf tour in Asia. And that was sort of the next bigger project, and it required even more capital, more resources. So I kind of switched over there, and that office, or the head office of the federation, was in Malaysia, and I decided I'm joining you. It had something to do with my ex-wife, who was Malaysian, for me to say, let me go there and set up, you know, shop. So I was in Malaysia when I then decided to go on my own, and I had a local partner. That's correct. He was an older gentleman. He was about probably 10, maybe 15 years older than me. And he came from the advertising industry. So he had this sort of, okay, I kind of know brands. I know people. You know a bit about this whole sports world. Okay, why don't we try this out? And at that time, there was, outside of the agencies where I came from, which was a, let's call it, Asian-originated agency. The other agencies were just some of the bigger global agencies like IMG or others who had some offices in Asia, but it was very, very early days. Right? It was really the Wild West or the Wild East in sports there, for sure.
How many pitches do you think you did in that first year?
Interesting. So this is, I guess I'm trying not to go too deep into all these because we can spend hours on this stuff. But so our original business plan was to take over the commercial rights of the Malaysian Football League.
Oh, clever.
So we had offered $10 million, which was a lot of money at those times, to the league to say, we take over your TV rights and your sponsorship deal. And on the back of it, we will then commercialize it. Now, what we had done in the process, it was sort of the, if you think back of the UK, when, you know, Sky took over Premier League rights and kind of grew their business on the back of it. Well, this is sort of similar time. The local pay TV operator had just started, and we convinced them that local football is important to grow your business further. And so they were ready to write a nice big check. We had, you know, still some interesting sponsorship opportunities. Cigarette money was still allowed, and that was quite still a big sponsor during those times. So we thought we had it all nicely lined up. And then the later part of 97 was a huge financial crisis in Asia, started in Thailand and then basically spread around the whole region. And it just, everything basically blew up. Entire business plan, everything just went out of the window.
Often happens. Nothing unusual.
So luckily, we had not signed this contract, which was a five-year contract. So let's say $50 million worth we were committing. We hadn't signed it, and we bailed out. By December that year, we had nothing. That was our business. There wasn't another plan.
Yeah, brilliant. Every company,
because it was big enough. Like it was big enough. You know, it would, if it all worked out, it would have, you know, created a nice business right from the get go. Now here we are, that December, and it was one of those moments where you go, "Hey, what the hell are you doing now?"
Which is when the brain comes alive. So what did you do next?
Correct. Yeah. And this is sort of, you know, I always say that is that I think somewhat my maybe entrepreneurial DNA went into a bit of an overdrive, because I had some offers for people saying, hey, come back, work for me for whatever, this company, that company, in this similar space, of course. But somehow I felt, you know what, I don't want to do this. I want to do this on my own. I feel I have the tools, or I have, you know, the ability to do it. And there's a way we can offer something which is different than others. And we stuck with it. And then we were maybe a bit lucky, 98, even though the financial crisis wasn't really gone yet, or was still in full swing. Malaysia was hosting the Commonwealth Games, the 1998 Commonwealth Games. And so we ended up with some interesting business there. We were helping brands who had committed sponsorship funds to basically leverage it, activate it. So we're doing, you know, traditional sports marketing in a sense. And then we had a few other clients. And, you know, year one, by the end of that year, so the first really full year of 98 operating, you know, we kind of made a little profit, and we looked like a real little company all of a sudden, and grew from there.
And so when did TSA actually turn a corner? What was the point where you stopped the usual treadmill of any startup, of any company? You know, you can fail three times before one company business model works. It's totally normal. And then obviously that business model may work and you have to create another one. What was the point where you actually saw liftoff, where you actually thought, actually, I'm no longer worried about my rent, my mortgage, I'm not going to lose my house next month?
What's the tipping point?
Yeah.
I mean, to some degree, yeah, it was in year one. Year one was looked good, and we looked a whole lot smarter than the year before, obviously, that December where it all fell apart. But it was probably, let's say, 98. So about probably the year 2000, let's say year two or three of the business. We were very lucky to pick up a nice piece of business, which we then grew massively, which was WWE.
Oh my God. Wrestling. Wow. Jesus.
How on earth did you get them?
So we were, as I said, initially we were probably more focused on local activities and local things. But it, you know, as I said, with my background and I guess my own ambitions, it was always clear that we really wanted to be an international agency working with global IP owners, whether it's the WWEs or the football clubs in Europe or others, and helping them do things in Asia. That was really what I wanted to do. And leveraging, I guess, that I was an Asian and that I had relationships in Europe, or, you know, that I look and sound like an American sometimes. you know, those things were just, I'm the token guy on the ground there, and they trust me, and then trust us to help them, you know, build businesses here.
So just talk to me in real layman's terms. Let's just say the Premier League, they're sponsored by whatever they are, Coors, 00 Peroni, whatever it is. Are you getting those advertising deals for them, or are you then given that? They say, come to you and they say, we've got this, this, and this, and this. We've plowed all this money into this. Can you monetize this and make this work as best you possibly can?
We did a little bit of that, the second part you just mentioned, but as an agency, we were on the sales side. So our job was find us money in Asia, right? So go find me the money,
basically. How did you do that? Show me the money. Because that's quite hard, yes.
Yeah, so exactly. It is harder. But what we, so we concentrated on a couple of buckets. One is the media side of it, as in selling television rights. And these numbers just started to explode, yeah. And the appetite for international content in Asia was always there. But, you know, we were, I guess, one of the agencies who helped fuel it. And, you know, maybe I'll use the WWE as an example. So when we started with them, they were making a few hundred thousand dollars in Asia, basically nothing almost, right? They were a huge brand in the US and they had good visibility, but they just weren't monetizing it. And so we took them from, as I said, a few hundred K to tens of millions of dollars.
Really?
By the time we were, I always say we worked ourselves out of a job 8 years later, we had done $170 million worth of revenue for them.
Wow. So that is, would you say that was your big break?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Because what you've got there, which I would imagine is so rare, there is a sport which is already taken off in the States that no one has had the wherewithal to think, I'm going to take this to Asia and do what you did with it. There are very few sports I can even think of that you could pick up now. That is like a jewel in the crown, which will probably never come along again for you, right?
No, absolutely. When we first started it, we were being sent the American product, right? Now, there is no Asian fighter, right? I mean, maybe there was one little Japanese guy somewhat getting beaten up constantly, but that was about it, right? There was no relevance to Asia as in, okay, there is, you know, athletes actually doing things. So what we really did well, I think, is that we went away from trying to pitch it as a sports product, but we pitched it as a sequential entertainment for men, you know, like a soap opera for men.
Absolutely,
really. And
right.
Once the broadcaster got their head around it, that is, because it's sequential, means it, you know, like a good soap opera, it kind of builds on each other each episode. And you create these time slots where, okay, once you lock it in, it's Monday night at 10 o'clock, whatever, that customer or that consumer or that fan comes back every time over and over and over. And it's very, you know, and that's in sport, somewhat you have that as well, because you obviously have weekly competitions around the world. But WWE is very unique because of the way the content is structured. And I think that was the big difference. Previous agents or others who were selling it as a sports thing. And they're basically, well, I had people throw me out of the office saying, Marcus, this will never air on my broadcaster. And then we did a little trick on it. We gave him merchandise for his kit. So I knew maybe he had a son of 10, 15 years old. So here's a T-shirt, here's a whatever. And I promise you, that same guy called me back a week later saying, Marcus, you know what? I gave the shirt to my son and he thought I was the coolest dad ever. And then he educated me a little bit of why WWE is such a cool thing. And maybe we might have a look at this. You know, can you believe that? I mean, from Lurie's throwing me out of the office to being humble enough to say, look, maybe I was wrong because it's not I have to like it, but clearly there is an audience for it. And I think that is the trick, right? The more we were doing this and the more we found this, these hooks, we realized, there is a way to sell it.
Marcus, basically, you're a salesman, right? You're obviously a very clever man, marketeer and all the rest. But ultimately, ultimately, you're a salesman. That's what you're really doing, right?
I'll take that as a badge of honor.
So, and bloody good one as well. Do you have a thick skin in business? Do you take no? You know, have you got the ball? I know you're obviously in a completely different situation now and you're well established. You don't have to. Are you the type of guy that can pick up the phone and cold call?
Yeah, we did that. Absolutely. I think we, you know, in the early days, there were tons of cold calls going on and tons of no's. Or as I said, even in the WWE days, right, where you think now where you're going, oh my God, what an amazing product, but it wasn't easy.
Can I just ask, do you think that what you found is that you found an absolute passion. You found a love of what you did. And once you got the bit, you just kept driving and driving and driving. And if you keep driving, you will always find the opportunity. And I think what the combination that's unique is your risk profile is perhaps higher than even most entrepreneurs. Because you're going into so many cross different, countries and cultures. I mean, how many languages do you speak?
Funny enough, I don't speak any Asian language, and that's You know, to be honest, and this is maybe the good thing. Good is the wrong word. I always felt it's better if I hire native speakers who, you know, bridge that gap than me trying to pick up, you know, a bit of Japanese, a bit of Chinese, a bit of God knows what. I mean, I speak a few words here and there, of course, to kind of, you know, break the ice maybe in the first meeting. But no, I, you know, besides speaking German, of course, no, I don't speak Asian languages. You know, I wish I could, of course, if you had that ability as well.
So the question, I mean, listen, in my businesses, I spent my whole life slightly different, but hiring marketeers and especially PRs, right? I think in 35 years of business, I've only ever been happy with one PR, and the rest I thought were all rubbish, right? And I think we drive when we're paying a fee, whether it's a big sports conglomerate to you or whether it's me to a PR or whatever, you're never really satisfied. Is how difficult is it to manage these massive clients that you have?
I mean, in WWE's case, a great example. So after 8 years making lots of money for them and us, they decided we were getting paid too much money as commissions. And they ended up setting up their own offices pretty much everywhere, right? So they set up in Japan, China, et cetera. So they basically said, look, we're a public listed company on the New York Stock Exchange. You know, we got to have our own office. We can't do this through agents anymore, right? And so, what I feel is we constantly, if we did a great job, we somewhat worked ourselves out of a job in two ways. One is either the client itself saying, hey, now Asia has become big enough and maybe we need offices or we need people, our own people on the ground. Or, and this is other examples in, let's say, badminton or table tennis, which were smaller and maybe more Asian indigenous sports. Again, we picked them up when there were a few hundred thousand dollars worth of revenue, and then 2, 3, 4, 5 years later, they were in the multi-million dollars, $5, $6, $7, whatever million dollars worth of revenue lines. The bigger agencies then woke up to them and saying, oh, okay, now it's big enough for us as IMG to have a look at it, right? For them, if this thing makes $500,000, it's too small. Now it's at $5 million. Okay, you know, maybe can we take it from 5 to 10 now or whatever? Then it's large enough and it makes a difference to them, right? And so you're constantly leery with your own success, creating your own problems.
Of course, yes, 100%.
That's absolutely right. You're creating the monster. I remember a PR once telling me exactly that. She said, you know, when I came to you, now look what I've created, you're a bloody monster. And it's true. And I think she did say that slightly tongue in cheek, only slightly. But, you know, that is the nature of that piece. Now, is there a little gem that you've just picked up? What's hide lurking in the background? Paddle tennis. How about that?
I play it. I'm not totally convinced yet. There is there is that much industry. There's so much money in
it's
it.
It's taking off in such a massive way.
Yeah. No, I think it's a great sport, and I enjoy playing it. The commercialization around it, I think, is still
really
stuff.
Really. Why would that be?
Well, two things. We are always more on the professional side of the sport, not on the mass participation sport, right? So, yes, there are clubs or courts popping up all around the world. In Bangkok, you know, around where I live there are several clubs. And you know, if you want to be in that business as building facilities, great. That's not my space.
Yes.
But the professional space, which meaning, you know, having top athletes competing against each other, broadcasting it around the world, bringing sponsors in, it's still in an infancy. I couldn't tell you the scale and size, but I would be surprised if the whole is bigger than $20 or $30 million. Now, as an agency, it's a very, very hard space. But it's a bit like I said, the conversation we had earlier. If you come in now and if they can take a good position in it and you'd get this thing from 20, 30 to 100 million in the next, I don't know, 5 years, there is lots of interesting opportunities in it. Right?
What is the exciting one? Can you name a couple that you've picked up that you really, really feel really good about?
So let me tell you that I think it's a good segue into what is SMS Capital, or I call it Smurf Capital.
I did call you Smurf. I thought, does he realize he called it Smurf?
No, I do. I do. Absolutely. And actually, I call it myself that. But some people,
it's
obviously,
brilliant.
They look at you a bit funny.
That's why I said SMRF.
So SMRF stands for Sports Media Rights Financing. So I'll give you the crash course on what that means, and that answers a bit. So think of my first, let's call it 25 years in this industry as being on the commercial world, right? Raising, finding the revenue streams, right? And, you know, the top line is past $500 million across those things. So it's a decent chunk of money. Now, my goal myself, I set for myself, was saying, okay, it took me 20 years to do these 500 million there. Let's do a billion in 10.
Yes, so, absolutely.
You know, half the time, double the amount. So that was sort of, you know, the onset. This is sort of during COVID, really, where I was kind of recalibrating a bit, you know, where do I want to be and what I want to do. And it was also clear I didn't want to just sell more sponsorship and more TV deals. It's kind of like you've done this so long that it didn't really get me out of bed anymore, right? But I was always fascinated by the finance sector or the finance world and how they were obviously, you know, what they were doing. So I figured, okay, how do I bring that capital, that sort of these billions of dollars, which are literally sitting around the world and always looking for a home or looking for a smart home,
always.
Right? Investors are always looking for what is the next better way? Where can I get a better return? Da, da, da. So I partnered with a group of folks who basically come from that world, you know, had banking backgrounds and, or, you know, setting up hedge funds, et cetera, in their past. And we started talking and saying, okay, how do we bring those two worlds together? And COVID, of course, was a unique time as well, where the sports world was hurting in a big way because you had no spectators in stadiums, right? So there was not a single sport on the planet which wasn't struggling in some form or shape, needed capital. And whether it was the league looking for it, whether it's the club itself or whether whatever, you know, event organizers around the world. So during that time, it was very clear there's capital requirements. Now, the financial world, the big private equity groups and others aren't sports people, right? So they have their very, you know, way of looking at the world. And sometimes dealing with the sports guys, which I deal with my whole life, we talk in different languages.
They
like
do.
The Chinese talking to someone in Europe, you know, or India. So they're not really, even though they think they say the same thing, they're not really, right? And that was very clear again, a bit like with TSA, there was this gap, which no one was really catering to the way I felt we could with the skills and the knowledge of people we had, right? And we have a couple of people like me who come from the sports world, and then we have a couple of very smart people from the finance or banking, et cetera, world, right? And so putting our heads together and saying, look, let's go in the market. And so what we then created, we looked at what type of capital is there. You have the equity, basic, you know, private equity stuff, and you have your debt financing, which are banks and others who bring this up. The part which was missing and which was sort of created around the time because we were seeing others doing it was what we now refer to royalty financing, or we initially called it revenue financing. So now royalty financing in the finance world exists already. It's existed in many other industries where you underwrite, you provide capital on the back of future revenue, which you can forecast. So if you build a factory and you know how much output this has, you can sort of say, fine, I'll take a slice of that, knowing that once you're up and running, I'll get my back, right, money back. So we do the same. We look at let's take a football team, an average team in Europe who makes, I don't know, 100 million euros, $100 million revenue line. We look at that and we forecast that out 10, 15, 20 years into the future, do some, you know, fancy, you know, math around it. And it would spit out and saying, okay, if we take 5% stake of your future revenue for the next 10 or 15 years, I can write you a check of 50 or whatever, $75 million now. Right. So it is a, you know, basically forward looking revenue streams, analyzing that, seeing where it grows, how it could be flat up and down. And again, if you think of it, that's what I did for 25 years. Right. This the commercial world is where I live and breathe. So
putting that into a memorandum is very difficult.
Correct. You know, so now, but, you know, and initially it took a while for people to kind of get their head around it. Now it's, you know, it is actually happening. There are deals like this out there. The big boys like CVC or others have done very large deals and the billions of dollars with leaks to provide funding that way. So our model or what we were kind of building as this was being established has been validated now for sure. And so it's a really interesting space because that's where it gets interesting. We don't take equity, right? So we don't need to have the tougher equity conversation. What's the valuation of your property, you know, whether it's a football team or whatever it is. In the federation world, which is still a lot of sports they're not all businesses, right? They're not all, you know, registered companies. Dealing with equity is very difficult, right? For them to say, well, I give you a slice of the, you know, FIFA, it's impossible.
Yeah.
right? But to say, look, I'll just take a slice of your future revenue, we can all agree that's not a debate. I know where your revenue is now, right? It's just a P&L line, and I can figure it out from there. And then we just agree on what is it, what capital you need, and what capital or what percentage we would need to make our return, and bingo. So, one thing when you ask earlier, is it a fund? So our original plan was a closed-end fund in the UK, and maybe that wasn't the right place. In hindsight, it wasn't. It was at the height of music closed-end funds. So Hypnosis was doing really well. And so there, some people looked at what we were doing in sports at a similarity, even though there is a big difference to music and sports. But at least there was a story which people quickly caught on with. And we did a roadshow. We did all this sort of stuff. 9 out of 10 were going, yep, we're ready to come in with money, et cetera, et cetera. And then Russia invaded Ukraine and basically all went pear-shaped. And of course, no one in the UK has raised a dollar in a closed-end fund since then. Now, what we then realized, as usual, a bit like the story earlier on DSA, we were on the right track. We had, and it's not like our concept was wrong. It was just maybe, as usual, a little bad timing on something. So we partnered with existing groups, large funds in different parts of the world. So we have a partner in Europe, we have a partner in the US, and partner here in Asia, who have the capital. So at the moment, we're a bit more, bringing deals to it. But in the long run, yes, we still want to build our own fund and managing a sense that capital directly. But that has taken longer than we initially anticipated.
It always does. So, Mark, exactly. I'm just conscious we're going to be wrapping up soon. Ros will wrap up. One question that I wanted to ask you, which I ask everybody, as an entrepreneur, did you have any sight? Did you set this up with any exit in mind? When you started, did you have a plan? Was there a big plan for the exit?
No.
Simple answer. The funny thing is? Every single person that we interview and they're entrepreneurs, I'm the same, she's the same. But actually, I shouldn't use that swear word, that very popular podcast, the Diary of a CEO. Which is, you may not have heard it, but it's a big one here, sort of entrepreneurs and all these sort of things. He's absolutely convinced that you don't start any business unless you have an exit in mind. Well, not one entrepreneur that we've interviewed has said they had an exit in mind. You just fly by the seat of your pants, don't you? You stick your finger in the wind as an entrepreneur and you just run with it.
Yeah, in hindsight, and after probably reading a few more books and stuff, you're going, yep, maybe that's the way you should have done it and be more ruthless about it. And my exit probably should have been when we were, growing like crazy for 10 years and you get up with a nice multiple and off you go and you theoretically start the new thing. But that's not what I did.
Do you have an exit in plan now, just before we wrap?
I would say we have much more of a growth plan right now and the ambition first. I think there is in other businesses, and this is maybe the better way to answer it. So obviously as you see on my LinkedIn profile, there's multiple businesses and other things. They were much more focused on, okay, we know we got a 3-year window, we got a 2-year window, we got a whatever, 5-year window. Let's make it happen. Get in, get out, and you move on. So I think you do learn your lessons a bit on that.
We have 5 to 10 minutes left, so we are going to have to wrap up, which I'm very sad about because it's been
absolutely wonderful. Thoroughly enjoyed it.
We have a little
tradition on a podcast. We have 3 questions.
Okay, I want to ask you because you've mentioned it twice now. You're clearly an avid learner. You clearly have mentioned that you have, and I'm assuming multiple books over your time of building companies and businesses. What would you say to anyone listening or to any CEO or any other entrepreneur would be the 2 first books you'd pick up that are your go-to for everything and anything that relates to business?
Wow. There's usually now the question is, do they come in my mind, the titles and all these things, but, I'll answer slightly different, but, it probably has the same, effect. The book, which turned me into an entrepreneur, it's called Awakening the Giant Within by Tony Robbins.
Oh, I like that. I like the sound of that.
Yeah, I'm a huge Tony fan anyway.
Yeah,
I spent an unbelievable amount of time with him over the years when I first built the business, but that book it sort of triggered it, because it kind of forces you to think into the future. You know, where do you want to be in 5 years, 10 years, interesting, et cetera, sometime? And to me, that is where I realized some of these things I can't achieve by having a nice job or being employed somewhere, right? And I think that's sort of really, so if you're not an entrepreneur yet, and sort of, you know, want to get a bit in it, I think, you know, there's some really interesting books out there.
Yeah.
You know, and then of course it is, you know, I do like these, the sort of books, which let's call them, not self-help is the wrong word, you know, sort of the motivational kind of books, which kind of gets you, you know, in the right mindset, because never mind the technical books. I mean, there are lots of great books about how to do this and how to do that and whatever, right? But I think in my view, as an entrepreneur, and I think if you read this, I hear it all the time, it really is the level of pain you can endure and or the level of risk you're willing to take. Mm-hmm. And that is nothing you can, you know, you can learn it. I think that's, it's not, you're born with it. That's not my point much. But you have to have a really strong self-belief, and also mechanism to deal with that stress level, right?
Absolutely, you know, look, right.
When we had 100 people in 8 offices, you know, as I said, you know, that the overhead was large. It was definitely large for an agency level. And one of my mentors always kept telling me, Marcus, watch out. Your overheads will kill you. Because you end up working just for the people, right? You know, before you take a dollar out, you got to pay 100 other guys, in a sense, right? Yeah. And so, you know, so to me, you know, having that ability to actually still sleep at night and not waking up, you know, in sweat and panicking every time something doesn't go
right—that
right,
is an ability.
Where 100 people and their livelihood depends on you a little bit, at least, or to a larger extent. Is big, no, and never mind you have thousands of people or God knows what how big you are, right? I think that is to me the books you want to pick up, because that is what's going to challenge you the most, not being the smartest guy in certain disciplines, I think.
So, Lars, another question. Right, you're made Prime Minister today. What's the one thing that you change?
Obviously, being European, I think the Brexit was the dumbest thing the UK has ever done.
100%. And I'm glad you answered in that way. And I knew you were going to answer in that way. And that's what most people say. So, and then we one last question.
Okay, I love this question. But I just need to say something to you. I think that poignant moment, I think that each entrepreneur, every entrepreneur has, you know, I always think that if someone who hadn't been through the knocks and the rise of what it is to be an entrepreneur, I think if they actually walked into the body of an entrepreneur, they'd probably drop dead because of the amount of actual stress that can flow through the physical body and mind of an entrepreneur. And I think that it is about lightness. It is about actually waking up and realizing that you have to be relentless and believe in yourself no matter what. So my last question is completely lighthearted, but when you were growing up, did you have a favorite rock star, Black Sabbath, rock, opera?
Yeah, so 80s, you can sign me up every day. And I'm not sure I have a particular band, but I just love the music in general, and I still listen to it today, you know, a bit of 90s. So, but yeah, all those sort of things. So I'm always more, you know, whatever was the hit at the radio, at the charts, that was sort of the kind of music I would go for. Obviously, you know, there's some German bands as well, which fall into the space. But, you know, I was probably looking, you know, for inspiration, it was always sports athletes, right? Yeah. You know, I grew up with Boris Becker, him winning Wimbledon the first time, and, you know, or, you know, it goes in the football world or boxing, et cetera. And yeah, those are the things which kind of got me, right? I must have watched Rocky 100 times because I just love the underdog thing and this whole sort of inspirational. So, you know, this is a funny story, actually. When I was young, I would get teary eyes watching an athlete perform and doing amazing things. And I still have that when I was studying in the US and I was watching Michael Jordan do this, right? And I wouldn't have the same when I watch a movie, right? If there's something sad, it was just okay. But you give me a sports piece, which is sort of a bit of nice underlying music and the whole thing. That's it. You'll see me having little tears here, right? And I always thought it was a bit weird. No. You know, why would I be so emotional about sports? Well, having a career now for the last 30 years in it, I guess it's sort of explicit.
Yeah, totally.
It's in your heart.
So, Marcus, where can all our viewers and listeners find you? What social channels you have? Is there anyone thing you want to plug?
Well, I have a website. It's called marcuslua.com. So that's the easy one to find me. Obviously, if you want to have a bit of, you know, background, what I do, I'm very active on LinkedIn. So you'll find me there. And I do have business channels for my podcast, the Sports Entrepreneurs Podcast. So, you know, there's Instagram, there's, you know, TikTok and other accounts out there. So I'm everywhere.
So Marcus Lua, founder of SMFR Capital and TSA Total Sports Asia and so many other companies. This has been such a joy to interview you and so inspirational, not just for us, but for all our listeners and viewers. So all that remains from both of us is to thank you so much for your time and for being so generous and sharing what you have today.
Richard and Russ, thank you for your time, and I really enjoyed it. And as I said, as a fellow podcast host, it was fun. I really enjoyed. Great questions, and thank you.
Thanks once again for listening to this episode of V for Visionaries, the how-to podcast.
We would love it if you could take a moment to click the follow button and hit 5 stars, as it really helps grow the show.
We'll see you in the next episode of V for Visionaries.